Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Donald Trump calls himself a peacemaker. His actions betray his words. When it comes to the Middle East, he is an obvious war president. This begs the question, does he have a coherent Middle East strategy beyond Israel's security interests? Has he entered into a war against Iran he can't finish? Crosstalking the changing Middle East, I'm joined by my guest, Daniel McAdams in Lake Jackson. He is the executive director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. In Paris, we have Elijah Magnier. He is a veteran war correspondent and a political analyst. And in Tel Aviv, we cross to Alon Pinkas. He is a former Israeli diplomat and writer. All right, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Daniel, you got up earliest in the morning, so I'm going to go to you first. I hope that coffee is strong. Does Trump have a strategy for the Middle East, or is he just simply an opportunist, easily influenced? I think the jury is out right now. If he thinks this conflict that Israel and the United States initiated against Iran is over, I think he's going to have a rude awakening. Daniel.
The answer, Peter, is that he has no strategy for the Middle East. In fact, he has no strategy whatsoever for his presidency. There's no guiding principles that he has. If you look at his foreign policy team, they're basically empty suits. Marco Rubio has no foreign policy vision whatsoever, and he also has no power. I mean, this is a comical presidency. President Trump just announced that on July 4th, in the United States, he's going to have a massive flyover of Washington, D.C. from the B-2 bombers that obliterated Iran's nuclear power capabilities, He's going to have the pilots there. Peter, this is a kind of reality TV show presidency where the plot twists come about with the aid of his handheld device or some new plot twist will be entered into it, and everyone will ooh and ah. It's really becoming, and I think the rest of the world is very tired. They don't want season three of this. It's a bad TV show.
Well, I got you here, Daniel. I mean, with this budget that Trump has proposed, it's a $1 trillion defense budget. Well, where's all the ammunition? It seems to be in shortage all over the. What are they spending their money on?
Well, we just found out that President Biden's entire military team has just started a new lobbying group. Imagine that. Lloyd Austin is going to be a big lobbyist, as are all of his deputies. They're going to make tons and tons of money. So you have a big, huge bunch of very rich people around the Beltway and no bombs left.
Okay. We'll have to have a separate program explaining how that happened. But money is always the start of every investigation in Washington. Elijah, let me go to you. You know, right now, Iran has walked away from the IAEA. There are no longer any inspections. It was the most investigated nuclear program in the history of the IAEA. And now it's approaching what Israel has is strategic ambiguity. Israel claims that it doesn't make public its program or the number of bombs it has. Iran is quickly going to do the same. Why shouldn't it, Elijah?
Well, actually, you're right. You said that Iran stopped the visit of the IAEA inspectors. By the way, the IAEA has 200 inspectors worldwide, of which 130 operate in Iran. But as your guest rightly said, Donald Trump said it has completely destroyed all Iranian sites. So why the inspectors need to visit something that is completely destroyed? Trump and Netanyahu said they have obliterated these sites and there is no more program. We heard the Pentagon saying that at least for the next 2 years, Iran cannot even start a nuclear program. So basically, Iran is not doing anything wrong by saying, I have so many rocks in the way, I can't remove them. I need 2 years to remove them, quoting the Pentagon. Therefore, not allowing the IAEA to come in is just fair. Now, it is true that Iran can do much better than that. But now Iran has understood that the only way to deal with the Americans is really to work with diplomacy, but with a total nuclear blackout. therefore no information coming out. They've accused the director, Rafael Rossi, of being spying on Iran, delivering information to the Israelis and to the Americans. And they said, we really don't want him to come and tell the Americans what is left so they can go and bomb him again, because this is exactly what Donald Trump said. So they're not giving the Americans another opportunity.
Well, and with the IAEA or without the IAEA, it seems like it will be used to start a second round. But we have to remember, everybody, this is a truce. It's a ceasefire. There's no end here. Alana, if I can go to you in Tel Aviv, is Israel any safer after its attack on Iran and the American attack on Iran? Is Israel's security any better off now than it was then?
Well, Peter, before I begin, I'd like to express my protest that Daniel took all my notes about Trump not having a policy, and
Daniel has this amazing ability to read my questions, too.
Now I have to ad-lib the next 25 minutes. But answering your question, Peter, look, there are two ways of looking at it. One is that Israel was safer under the JCPOA. Whatever flaws it had, it provided more than these bombardments. The second, three ways of looking at it. The second way of looking at it is that throughout 2024 and during the 12-day war in June of 2025, Israel further weakened Iran geopolitically via the loss of the of some of the proxy network, particularly the prized proxy Hezbollah in Lebanon, the loss of Assad's regime in Syria, the subsequent evacuation of the small but nonetheless important symbolically Russian contingent in Syria, and that weakened Iran. So from that perspective, Israel feels geopolitically stronger. The third way relates to what Elijah was talking about, and that is, guys, the idea was to eliminate, obliterate, annihilate, decimate, use your word, Iran's nuclear program. Now, there are two questions here. What exactly happened in Fordo, Natanz, and Isfahan? Let's take not the obliteration, but the two-year setback. That's hardly enough. And the second, perhaps more important and potentially critical issue, is where the hell, excuse my Russian, where the hell are the 400 kilos, 900 pounds of enriched 60%? But nonetheless, enriched uranium. Is there some pizza delivery guy running around with 400 kilos in the back of his pickup? I don't know, but we don't know where it is.
Well, that's going to be, if I can go back to Daniel here, that's going to keep some people up late at night, and it'll be that'll be the next strategy for the next bombing raid here. This, Trump, maybe he was tricked into believing that, this is a one-off. This is one-off, one mission, and it's all over. Well, if he was given that advice, he was lied to, because he started a precedent, and now he's put his foot in the stream, and he can't take it out. Daniel.
This is exactly what the neocons did to George W. Bush in 2002 with Iraq. This is going to be a cakewalk, Mr. President. 1 week, we'll be in and out. It'll pay for itself. We'll be greeted as liberators. This is easy. Don't listen. Yeah, slam dunk. That's right. Don't listen to the naysayers. But here's something that's different. Back in 2002, with the ramp up to the Iraq war, there was stovepiping of U.S. intelligence certainly in the Pentagon. All of the stuff that led toward war got straight to the president's ears. Anything that warned of any downside was put away to the side. Well, this is actually even worse, because the John Ratcliffe intervention was incredibly important, because John Ratcliffe came forward and said, no, they're having a breakout right now. They're within days of having a bomb. Well, that information, where did it come from? Did it come from American sources? No. We know that it didn't, because Tulsi Gabbard told us it didn't. These were Mossad, these were Israeli intelligence sources. They obviously have an interest in presenting a narrative. That's not how the intelligence system is supposed to work. If you can't trust our intelligence communities to make a rational assessment, then we've got a bigger problem. So it's even worse than stovepiping. It's just listening to a foreign intelligence organization and letting that drive your policy.
Well, Elijah, and so this is we've started down a path, which I said in my introduction, Trump might not be able to know how to stop or even end another endless war, which will be even more catastrophic for the region. Elijah in Paris, go ahead.
There are two issues here. First, Benjamin Netanyahu feels very strong. Therefore, he cannot stop today. He has different options. Either kill the Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei or kill Hezbollah leader Sheikh Naim Qassem and regain another war on Lebanon or start attacking Yemen. He cannot stop now because he wants to try and finish the job. However, there is another point that everybody, I think, is omitting around the world. The Americans are saying, we did not destroy Isfahan because we can't reach it. And we have Rafael Grossi telling us that he went down to 800 meters under the ground to explore and examine some of the Iranian sites. Therefore, if nobody can reach the 800 meters under the ground, it means Iran still has its facilities somewhere working. We have seen Iran having the knowledge, and that knowledge cannot be bombarded, cannot be destroyed. And the Iranians started from the first verbal cessation of hostility, or calm, or ceasefire, call it whatever you want. It's an agreement without an agreement. They've started rebuilding their missile program and their nuclear program. So is Donald Trump going to war against whom? He can't go to war against Iran because Israel asked to stop the war on day 7 and then 8, 9, 10, 11, until day 12, Iran agreed.
But Elijah, by the same logic there is then when will the war start again? When both sides have recovered from this round. Gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on the changing Middle East. Stay with RT.
I'll look forward to talking to you all.
That technology should work for people.
A robot must obey the orders given it by human beings, except where such orders would conflict with the first law.
Show your identification.
We should be very careful about artificial intelligence.
The point, obviously, is to create trust rather than fear.
I would like to take on various jobs.
I mean, with artificial intelligence, we are summoning the demon.
A robot must protect its own existence or its own existence.
Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing the changing Middle East. Okay, let's go back to Tel Aviv. Alon, can you explain something to us? I think Elijah and Daniel agree with me when I present this question here. What is the deal between Trump and Bibi Netanyahu? Because on Truth Social, he wrote two very, very long posts. It was so full of flattery and calling him a great war leader, one of the greatest leaders in history and all that. He doesn't talk about anyone that way, except for himself. So, I mean, you're in Tel Aviv, you're in Israel. I mean, do you have an angle that you can explain to us? Because a lot of Americans are saying, what is wrong with this man? Go ahead, in Tel Aviv.
Well, to be fair to Donald Trump, he did write love letters to Kim Jong-un of North Korea. So come on.
Yeah, you got a handshake out of that, and you got no war. So I stick up for Trump on that one. Keep going.
By the way, me too. Okay, here's the thing. This is not a good relationship necessarily, and it did not start well. Remember that Trump accused Netanyahu of two things. First, of not showing up and providing the assistance that he promised when the U.S. Target assassinated Qassem Soleimani in his first term. And then he held a grudge against him for, lo and behold, Netanyahu calling Biden after the 2020 election to congratulate
Arizona. Arizona, yeah, right, exactly.
Right. He was one of the four countries that were left out who did not call him, including Turkmenistan, Yemen, and North Korea, by the way. Okay, and then Netanyahu did what he had to do and called him, and he held a grudge. Then after the calamity and the debacle of October 7th, 2023, he called him a big loser. He said it happened on his watch, he's a loser, et cetera, et cetera. Then 2 weeks before the war in Iran, he implored Israel not to attack. In fact, the day before, he publicly said he wants Israel not to attack and that there is a sixth round of talks to be held in Muscat in Oman on Sunday. That was on a Thursday. The war began very early Friday morning. But the war went well. Technologically, militarily, the war was seen, you know, it's like a Hollywood movie. And Trump loves that. And he loves this winner thing, and he wanted to jump on the bandwagon. That's one reason why he's with them. The second reason is because the Saudis, I think, are pressuring him to cut a deal and end the war in Gaza, and for that he needs to cajole Netanyahu. The third is that corrupt leaders stick with each other, and they don't need a special reason to like each other. You know, they hang out. Every mob movie is based on
yeah, the Sopranos just comes right to my mind right when just when you said that there.
Okay, I just said the other day on Israeli television, someone said that exact same thing, Peter, about the Sopranos, and I said, guys, the Sopranos had charm. We're not dealing with charming people.
Well, even the Sopranos had some rules in their own way. Okay, they had their own code here. You know,
the fourth thing.
Go ahead.
Yeah, no. And the fourth thing that I would not rule out that spur of love coming out toward Netanyahu is a way to detract from the big, beautiful bill that's problematic, from immigration policy that is drawing him down in the polls, the tariffs policy that's not working, Ukraine that's not working. It's a way for him to distract. The same way that he spoke about Netanyahu in the last 2 weeks, he could flip within one day and say the nastiest things, and we all know that.
That's fair. But Daniel, the point I'm trying to drive in this program here is that the precedent that Trump took to bomb Iran, that it was his ticket in. And it's like the Hotel California. You can't check out because this isn't over yet, okay? So we believe that Trump fell for Israeli intelligence. Will he do it again? And, you know, because before, you know, Iran might get a bomb in a few days or a few weeks, but now it's flipped. It will get a bomb in the number of days, weeks, and months. That's the flip in all of this. And he's going to be pressured to do it again. And that will extend the war. And then the law of unintended consequences plays. Go ahead, Daniel.
Well, the thing is that Trump lives in the world of rainbow ponies, you know. But the reality is the U.S., when it helped Israel defend itself after Israel started a war that it couldn't finish, the U.S. expended, I think the report from Haaretz said 93 THAAD missiles. Yep. I don't remember how many Arrow 1 and 2 missiles. But you're talking about $1.5 billion, according to the article in Iran. That's $1.5 billion just in missiles, and then our big glorious bombing run that obliterated everything in sight. But I don't know how much would it have cost to move all of those assets around. Maybe $1 billion, maybe $2 billion. So that's $3.5 billion just for this little shoot. But the thing is, those 93 THAAD missiles that were expended in just 1 week of the war, I think that's the entire production capability of the United States for an entire year. The fact is that Trump can talk as tough as he wants, but there are no missiles to continue the war. What's he going to do, have a ground invasion? Good luck with that, Donald.
Well, Elijah, what kind of deterrence does Iran have right now? Because during the so-called 12-day war, Israel took damage, serious damage in many respects, particularly Haifa and other areas here. Does Iran now have deterrence to thwart off another attack, at least for the time being?
The Iranians have three options. First of all, they prove that for the first time in the history of Israel, many cities were hit, many locations were destroyed. And the Israelis never lived that ever in their life. Therefore, this is not something I was saying that the Israelis never seen that in their entire life. Therefore, this is something that the Israelis understood and they can continue doing in the next war. And they understand now much better what kind of missile they need to fire. So we've seen at the beginning they fired the old version of their missiles, introducing a new one every hit. And then now they understand which missile they can reach, which target. And they've been quite clever in reaching specific targets like the Weizmann Institute and other places that Israel emitted. However, the other two options they have is the Strait of Hormuz, and that they can cripple 20% of the world energy, and then they can, with the Houthis, Ansarullah in Yemen, closing the Red Sea, really disturb the whole traffic between Asia and the rest of the world. And the third option is the hitting the American bases in the Middle East. Although Iran is going to be hit hard, but between 1,600,000 square kilometers, the surface of Iran, and 20,000 square kilometers, Israel, I think Israel will be much more damaged, even if the Iranian missiles reach, let's say, 10%, and the Israeli managed to intercept 90 or 80%. I don't know, the percentage went down every single day after the day seven. Therefore, I don't think the Israelis are ready for another experience of this kind, but the Iranians are reconstructing their capability. They understood that the main breach was internal. Therefore, the Israeli were very clever with the Mossad and the CIA, because the Mossad director thanks the CIA for their joint operation. They were much more effective, not only with their dominant air force, but mainly internally with all the sabotage. And that is something that gave a wake-up call to the Iranians. So I think they have options, but I doubt they're going, everybody's going to go to another round.
Well, Ilan, I mean, I'm looking at officials, high officials in Israel, they've made it very clear that this is a truce or a ceasefire, that this isn't over. And just out of, you know, I can just ask you personally, living in Tel Aviv, what was it like during those 12 days?
Unpleasant. This apartment from which I'm talking had two windows smashed. My sister's building was hit. She's okay. I live not far from the IDF headquarters and the Defense Ministry headquarters, 200 meters to be exact. So you can imagine the noise. And that endless cycle of sirens and shelters, that was extraordinarily unpleasant in that respect. But, you know, Iran, going back to what Elijah said, the biggest deterrence that Iran has, which I doubt Israel understands fully, is attrition. If I take everything that Elijah said, it could be, diluted to one word, attrition. Because if Israel did not, with the U.S., did not obliterate, to use that fancy word, Iran's nuclear capabilities, and if the Iranian regime is in place, which it is, even though Israel was in a delusional way flirting with regime change, I don't know how that can happen, but that's a separate conversation. If that is all true, that means that we are entering a cyclical war, meaning that in 4 months, 6 months, even 12 months, we could see a reenactment of June 2025, because Israel will all of a sudden obtain actionable intelligence about Iran reconstituting its nuclear plan. And I think that is why Mr. Netanyahu is going to see Mr. Trump this coming Monday to talk about that. And in that respect, Elijah is absolutely right. Netanyahu feels euphorically strong. The military, by the way, and the Israeli intelligence are far less euphoric than he is.
Daniel, last 30 seconds go to you.
Well, I think there's a very serious lesson for the United States in what happened to Israel, as Elijah and Elon both pointed out, that the psychological impact of Israel being bombed, I can't imagine what it must have felt like, because Israelis felt like they were living in an absolutely protected bubble while they were attacking a lot of their neighbors. Now, the United States has been at war in a very, very far distant, far-flung way for many, many years and bombed and destroyed many, many countries. It's not as much fun when the war comes back to you. And that's a lesson for the Americans to start thinking about. God forbid, but these things do happen.
Yeah, well, one has to wonder, and we've been asking this question, gentlemen, for almost 10 years now. Does Donald Trump have a learning curve? Maybe a topic for another program. That's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Paris, Tel Aviv, and in Lake Jackson. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk Rules.